Happy Earth Day, and welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, and I'm really glad you could make it tonight. As curator of education, I'm privileged to be a part of this program. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series. We have 10 lectures in the fall and 10 in the spring. And tonight brings us to the end of our spring 2008 Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. It has been a really great run. And I'm already looking forward to the fall series, which begins in September. So I encourage you to look for the lineup on our website or as members in the mail, probably in about August. You might also be aware that Carol Walker, My Compliment, My Enemy, My Oppressor, My Love, that originated at the Walker Art Center, traveled to the Whitney and is now at the Arm & Hammer at UCLA, is coming to the Modern on July 3rd. And in conjunction with that exhibition, there's some really interesting programming. Sometimes the summer is quiet, so people might miss some of this. So I'm making the announcement to encourage you to look online for the programming that we'll be doing with that exhibition this summer. Tonight, we close the current Tuesday Evening series in such a perfect way with San Francisco artist Dean Byington. Perfect in that I saw Dean's work at his last solo exhibition at the Leslie Takano Artwork and Projects Gallery in New York this past fall. It was a show that received a great deal of critical acclaim with articles in the March issue of Free, some of you may have seen, and the most recent issue of Art in America, if you've received that yet. I was immediately enamored with the scale and the surfaces of these paintings, and upon closer inspection, the imagery. I wanted more time with them, and as luck would have it, I had a couple of spaces left for Tuesday evenings. So I extended the invitation, and like I said, perfect. I like it when those things come together. It feels like a really sincere offering. Dean Byington was born in Santa Monica. He grew up in L.A. He received a B.A. in 1980 from UC Santa Cruz, where he studied physics and architecture. And he also received his M.F.A. in painting from UC Berkeley in 1988. He has lived and worked in San Francisco, I think, ever since, for some time now anyhow. His work is represented by the gallery Paula Anglim in San Francisco, and as I said, Leslie Takano in New York. And his paintings are included in the upcoming Future Tense Reshaping the Landscape that opens soon at the Neuberger Museum of Art. Tonight we begin with Dean. He will be reading a statement, and that statement is for the purpose of giving you some things to observe and think about as the two of us move over to our seating situation over here to discuss aspects of the work while we move through these images. This will be pretty informal. Dean has is kind enough to have agreed to entertain my observations and questions in response to the work, and I'm really looking forward to this format. And while there is a lot to see and discuss, we will make every effort to leave time for your questions at the end. So form your questions as we're doing our back and forth up here. I'll try to anticipate some of your questions. Hopefully I will. But, of course, we want you to have time to ask those questions as well. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Please join me in welcoming Dean Byington.
I'd like to thank Terry Thornton for inviting me from San Francisco to come. It's a great crowd tonight. So I'm just going to read this statement, and it's a little long, but I'll run through it so that we can start talking about the work and looking at the slides. This is, you can't really see it, though. This, the reader, there's a reading figure in the middle, which has gotten darker over time, and behind him is Napoleon marching into Paris. Today I'm going to show you slides of work, and I've limited the selection to the last 12 or 14 years, skipping about 15 years of painting,
Before I start the slides, I have a few comments, but not about what the works mean. This is something that I feel is impossible to decipher. I'm very interested in history and can't prevent my old habits of analysis and speculation, especially when it comes to my history and wondering about how I got from there to here. I do feel that influences and sensations from my past provide conscious and unconscious reasons for the work I make and the way I make it. This doesn't mean that I'm not looking forward or responding to current events. These definitely have an effect on me and do feed into the subject matter of the paintings. Any mark you make has meaning, and although I'm always trying to go forward and forward, I'm very conscious of these past experiences which continue to circle through me, and nothing is ever finished until you leave. I never feel stuck in the past and shun nostalgia unless I can exploit it to make a compelling image. Three large experiences from my childhood have influenced my work greatly. The fact that both my mother and father met at and worked on the Manhattan Project, traveling with my family to gather geological samples in the Southwest Badlands, and growing up near the studio movie lots and storm drains in Los Angeles. These are not wholly dissimilar events, and they have somewhat intertwined over the years to form a complex landscape in my imagination. Working on the Manhattan Project was, of course, a huge experience for my parents, and they discussed it often at the dinner table. Their vivid descriptions of machines and experiments, Van de Graaff generators, plastic explosive lathes, and house-sized computers always had a subtext of menace. Even though we were in a different era after leaving New Mexico, the mood of the atomic age and the dark excitement of Los Alamos permeated our household. I believe that those stories have greatly influenced my imagination and work. I can't shake the profound image of the mounds of used badges worn to detect radiation exposure, especially around the Nevada blast sites. These badges were worn and then discarded into piles that usually read black, indicating a toxic level of exposure. I have a tendency to paint piles of things, which I believe signals these memories. Towers also seem to creep in, towers supporting machines, electrical wiring, or constructions of metal and wood. These drawings exist even in my earliest scribbling, and I have no doubt that the images of towers stem from the stories of the towers in the Nevada desert used to support the bombs and the components to monitor them. My mother was also a geologist and a rock hound, and we as a family spent many days traveling into the desert to collect samples and bring them back for cutting, polishing, and examining. We would travel into the desert and old mines looking for gemstones, geodes, and petrified wood and completely load up the Cadillac with specimens. This is a theme I've recently come back to with quite a bit of energy in a series of paintings titled Underground 1, 2, 3, and so on. Growing up in the movie lots, I spent most days after school with friends in the MGM or the Desilu sets. Desilu was formed by Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball in Culver City and owned nearly all the early TV show sets, such as Hogan's Heroes, Batman, Mayberry RFD, and The Andy Griffith Show. They also had huge movie sets of castles, old New York neighborhoods, Gotham City, forts, all kinds of disjointed arrangements of unrelated objects, unconnected trestle bridges, parts of an empty zoo, stalls of fake snow, railroad dining cars just beyond the front steps of Beverly Hills mansions. I remember huge water tanks with floating scale models of battleships, gunboats, and Mississippi steamboats. We used to play under the doghouse on the Hogan's Heroes set, really just a hole in the ground where the actors would wait to say their lines. Most of these lots were abandoned because this was the transitional time of outdoor sets versus indoor stages and on-location shooting. The overwhelming feeling here was abandonment and decay, the loss of the familiar, secure TV world to the knowledge of its behind-the-scenes ruin and falseness. We used to hang out in Floyd's barbershop, sitting in the barber chairs. So you can imagine when you turn on the television and see the actors, Floyd himself, in that same shop cutting Andy's hair. I think the creation of the set or stage and the dichotomy of the real and imagined still operates in my work like a proscenium. In the studios, an elaborate stair banister on a set would go up to a landing, turn the corner, and after that turn, out of sight of the camera, it would just end abruptly, cut off, no longer needed to complete the illusion. This is another signal, and although I'm unconcerned with this economy of labor, the studios taught me the uses of artifice to propel the story and set the mood. I should add that I spent an equal amount of time exploring the storm drains and sewers of L.A., usually entering them through the outer creeks and walking or bicycling for hours and hours through the dark tunnels against the flows to the sources near downtown. Although we wouldn't see anything too repellent other than rats and scum, the sound of unseen water running and dripping was ever present. And I'm convinced that this is one reason for my ongoing interest in Andrei Tarkovsky's films. I think the photo emulsion paintings relate to these experiences. This is a photo emulsion painting, by the way. Relate to these experiences in the movie sets through their sense and scale of drama and spectacle. The first pieces came out of daguerreotypes I collected for years, hunting for them at flea markets and antique dealers. Mainly, I was interested in the borders of the metal plates behind the mats or frames, areas in which the process of aging created a beautiful metallic coloring that was unrelated or separate from the toning of the photographic image itself. A dealer would show me daguerreotypes with masterfully made, beautifully preserved images, but I always wanted to open up the frames and look at the edges. They really couldn't figure out what I was after. And the more decomposed and singular the borders, the more I liked it, and I usually had little interest in the actual photo itself. If the photo was good or interesting, and the edges had the right look of aging, then it was a great day. The photos were important, but it was equally important to place a specific photo into the right frame of decomposition. I began to interchange images and borders, cutting and blending to orchestrate the right mood. To transpose these frames, I had to re-photograph the plates, and it was tough to get the image right, especially on such a large scale. Most of these pieces were 9 or 10 feet high and created in the darkroom. Like that one. My medium, so to speak, became old, sometimes historically significant photographs, and eventually I moved on from daguerreotypes to anonymous glass negatives. There's an interesting digression here. Most people are unaware that after the Civil War, there were a tremendous number of large glass negatives used to document the war, a very photographed war. After the war, these were often reused as glass panels in greenhouses because they were usually cut to a certain size. I've always felt fascinated by the idea of the sunlight passing through these graphic images onto the plants and flowers. Over time, the images would be bleached away by the sun, erasing their content. I began to make a series of large photo emulsion pieces titled Vanishing Georgia, inspired by the collection of the same title. The title is a contradiction because Georgia still exists, so what exactly is vanishing? The curator states, old houses, moss-covered trees, fields white with September cotton, people waiting at the depot to meet the train. To some, this evokes a feeling of nostalgia of a way of life fast disappearing. For others, it is a reminder, perhaps a bitter reminder, that the good old days were not always so good. I was fascinated by a photograph of Henry Campbell, tried and found guilty of murdering a black woman and one of her children. On the way to the gallows, he is asked to address the crowd. And what an expansive crowd it is. He stands on his own coffin and speaks calmly and eloquently to the people for several minutes. The accompanying text preserves his final declaration that, quote, an innocent man is going to his death, and the wagon moves on. In this image and others like it, I was struck by a powerful sense of being a witness and participant in the very same way that the crowd is. So I began to enlarge individual faces as a way to capture their expressions life size. I used the format of parallel film strips. This is a little, I'll show you these film strips in the slides, but I used the format of parallel film strips, obscuring the overall image, as a device to insert my own annotations into the scene. I didn't want to be didactic, I just wanted to respond instinctually. Anything could be employed or added into these small film strip boxes, and it was a great feeling to work on these smaller images juxtaposed against the huge backdrop of the busy crowd. At some point, I came across some engraved illustrations of fables and morality tales and incorporated them into the film strip mix. I didn't really need to agree with their points of view. I liked their irony and the fact that they could relate very directly or quite indirectly to the action in the photos. Unfortunately, by the time I'd finished the Vanishing Georgia pieces, I developed a terrible sensitivity to the photo developer chemicals and could not continue this work. Looking back, I'm a little mystified about my obsession with those edges and film strips. The delirium is over and time to move on. Where should I go from here? For no discernible or logical reason, I began to work with the fable or story images that I'd used in the film strips. I liked the way they were drawn, that 19th century overly descriptive realism and began to use and rework the images which accompanied the fables of La Fontaine and Florian. The idea of painting engravings, a contradiction, seemed promising. I could make my own world and draw it the way I wanted. Working on the photo pieces, it always seemed like I was on the outside looking in, and now in this new drawn work, it felt like I was on the inside looking out, and it felt better. What I really want to do is create the feeling that I've gone through a door into this world, but I'm unable to locate that door again to exit. What would that world look like? So I've developed an iconography of subject matter: rats, weasels, the war of the rats and weasels, caves, crystals, tree stumps, towers, Victorian-era machinery, real and imagined, water wheels, mining wheels, pathways through the brush, animals and insects in crisis, acts of violence, piles of gemstones, piles of anything and everything, doors and doorways, axes, signposts, environmental destruction, openings from one space to another, conflict, burrows, and of course, mushroom and vegetable families. All these things feel like they've been inside me for a long time, and I'm just trying to get out of their way. They baffle me too, and as Philip Guston once pointed out in regard to his own work, when I leave the studio at the end of the day, I feel like I've left a world more real than the world I see outside, which is a real shock when you step out into the sunlight. Ultimately, I think this is the most potent desire for the artist, to see it, what the mind can think and imagine. I also understand that in my way of working, this language operates in a maze-like and labyrinthine fashion for the viewer, and it is intentionally dense, a controlled visual overload. This is my way of slowing myself down. This is my way of slowing myself and the world down as connections are made and unmade. Thank you.
Maybe he'll correct me on that. So that was great. I read it initially, and I thought, well, that'll be good. It'll give everybody a few insights into the work, and then we can go on and talk about the work. But actually, he did talk quite a bit about the work with that statement. I've had the pleasure of seeing the work, so now you're going to get to see the work. Hopefully you can recall some of those things, and we'll try to make reference to them again, because after all, when given the time to think of exactly what it was he wanted to say about the work, the statement is what he came up with. So that is sure, those issues are sure to come up again. Okay, I wanted to begin, we'll move on to the next image here. I wanted to begin by just saying that I'm incredibly interested about this biographic aspect of the work. I'm really intrigued by your childhood as the son of a geologist and an engineer who worked on the Manhattan Project, your freedom to wander and explore storm drains and empty movie studios. But I want to begin by looking at the work, and I feel like that in the process of looking, that all of those things, those autobiographical aspects, will come up in the process of looking at and talking about the work itself. Both in how it looks and how it's made. So let's start with the earlier works in which you used the photo emulsion images and images from, you said, daguerreotypes, glass
negatives. Right, exactly.
Old photos.
This is a really big piece, but and this is a little different because it's actually layers of plastic where there's a kind of plastic called orthofilm where you can develop black and white images, and it's what would normally be white is clear,
mm-hmm.
so you're looking through maybe 10 or 12 layers of plastic images, of photographs on clear film into, and then on the background there's actually a painting back there that has this sort of garden motif.
Okay, so is this a work that's in process, or is this the way the pieces were
displayed? That's the way
displayed?
That's done. And actually, there's a last piece of film on top, and it's, I had these photos of this Russian woman who supposedly could move things kinetically with her mind. And
uh-huh.
She has this sort of glass box, and she's moving a cigar and these playing cards. And so I had those images, and I made them gigantic.
I'm sorry, Dean. I think your mic's not on.
Oh.
Oh, you know what I mean.
Hello?
Thank you, John. Sorry you guys missed that. It was great. Well, so since we're seeing this, and Dean's work, like a lot of really good work, suffers from not really reading in reproduction, obviously, like it does in person. So when we would see that, would you be able to make out those images?
You could if you went up to it and you started looking inside of it, you could. Well, I don't know if you could see all of it, but you could see a lot of it.
Okay, so these are like physically layered, like
right? Exactly.
Material on top of material.
Exactly, and the image is a little dark. You would be able to see more things, and actually, this Russian woman that was moving things is the last piece of film, and the film goes really high up to the ceiling, which is like 15 feet. So it's sort of, you had this plastic coming down, and then that's her head at the top. But she's like looking into this box, and in the box are all these objects that she's moving with her hands.
Like right here is her head?
Exactly.
Okay.
So you can see her eyes. So her head's just kind of chopped off.
Interesting. So this is a detail.
Yeah.
And the title is The Garden?
Mm-hmm.
You're perfect to have for Earth Day. I didn't think about that.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I like gardens.
Yeah, there are lots of them in your work.
Yeah, it's true, actually.
Well, I want to go through and look at these and get you to talk about some of the imagery and the process. But I also want to look at and to hear more about the development or the shift in the imagery that happens. I think it's interesting that it comes from you not being able to work with this material anymore. But
right.
To me, there's maybe I'm wrong. I'm thinking maybe I'm wrong now, though, now that we're talking about it. But to me, there seems to be kind of this enormous shift in terms of the imagery and the work when you. So let's look at some more of these.
Well, it was pretty, it was fairly black and white. I was in the hospital. I couldn't work with this stuff anymore. So it was almost like an overnight, okay, you can't do that anymore, and what are you going to do? So it was real sudden.
So,
which is sometimes a really good way to make the next thing.
Yeah. Why not?
Because it's like, I have no choice.
That's the end of that.
So there's that box again. I've used that box a lot.
The box being
the woman with this box, and she's controlling these things. So I didn't even need. I could put my own things into the box.
Oh.
You know, I could start, because that box came to mean something to me. It was sort of this controlling and moving of objects without, touching them. Using forces. It's like UFOs and things like that.
So you became like the Russian woman.
Essentially.
As an artist. That was kind of your role.
I didn't really think of myself that way, but I saw that I started to use that box in this metaphorical way where I could put anything into it and it would be transformed. It's an alchemical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about this piece? Because I know that this relates to your parents, your dad.
To my dad, actually. So all those objects, he is what he was working on at the Manhattan Project. And behind is this image of Tesla, actually, who is supposed to be a relative, but I don't know that for sure. But so there's all these sparks, and I just discovered these little glass negatives from Los Alamos in a stack of stuff It was after he died, and we were going through his things. And so I just started using them. They were just like photos, you know. And they were really, I mean, the way they were photographed, they're just beautiful. I think there's a detail of the lower.
Yeah. Yeah, they are
just
beautiful.
Yeah, they were just, you know, and to him, they were just a machine. But the way they were opened up and sort of presenting themselves, they were just really beautiful.
Are they kind of like that box?
Potentially, yeah.
Okay, this is Vanishing Georgia 1, so this is the culprit that put you in the hospital, right?
Well, it just, all of this stuff, because the way I think about it. I have this dark room that's 2,000 square feet. The studio I have now has no windows and doors. It's just this box. And because that's what I wanted, because I was working on all this photo stuff. So what I would do is I would build the canvas, and let's say it's 10 feet square, and I would take wood and I would build a ledge around the edge of the whole canvas. Mm-hmm. So I basically created a box. And then I would coat it with liquid emulsion, and then I would, of course, I'm doing this all in the dark. And I was going in the dark room, I was going in for the day. I mean, it was like I was in there all day. And I had a big enlarger that I could turn up to the wall, and I was putting these images onto the liquid emulsion. And I had no image. I had no idea what it was going to look like. I didn't even know, because if anybody's worked with liquid emulsion, it's not like film. It's really it depends on how old the emulsion is. The older it gets, the faster it develops. So you're sort of wrestling with all these things. You can't quite chart. And so after I had after I'd put these images onto the liquid emulsion, then I would put the canvas on the floor and I would just dump photo developer onto the canvas, and because of the edges, it became its own tray.
Right.
And then I would just dump it after I'd watch it come up under safe light, and then I would just dump it into a kiddie pool. I had one of these giant plastic pools, and I would dump it in the kiddie pool, and then I would dump the fixative on top, and then I would fix it, and then I'm running water, and I'm in the dark, and I'm using these plastic kiddie pools to collect all the material. So I was just immersed in this stuff, and I developed, it's like an asthma. A lot of photographers get it, especially with black and white chemistry.
Lesson to young artists.
Yeah.
Anyway. With this detail, you want to tell us a little bit? Now, you mentioned in the statement about Vanishing Georgia. Is this that image of...
Right. Actually, if we go back to the big one, you can't... So Henry Campbell, who is this...
Right here?
Yeah, he's in the middle, and he's a little hard to see. And this crowd is actually about 8 times bigger than that. I mean, it goes on. It is the biggest crowd, and everybody's wearing a hat for some reason. And the people in the foreground are looking at the camera. And then as you get moved back towards Henry, they start to look at Henry. So I should have included an image of just the whole scene because it's really an amazing photo. But
the fact that there's so many.
There's so many people, and they're just surrounding him. And so the film strips are made with varnish to make them yellower. And that's really the only... And then the boxes, I just use the boxes like blank canvases. It's like whatever I want to put in those boxes, I could.
So that's the film strip that you were referring
exactly.
to?
Exactly, and they're parallel, so there's, you know, sometimes they're much smaller and sometimes they're really big.
This one reminds me of one we'll see later, Home, that's the photo silk screening technique.
Mm-hmm. So actually this sort of came out of the... I think this preceded the film strip boxes, but I was making these using that same ortho film, and I was making contact negatives in big sheets, and I was collecting all of these photographs of extreme weather, like hurricanes and tornadoes, and I would just put the liquid emulsion on the canvas. In this case, there was an image already on it, and then I would put this like a contact negative onto the top of the emulsion, and I would just put lights on it for 2 weeks, and the lights would burn the images, the sort of a brown.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't turn black and white. It would just turn this kind of great gold brown color.
Kind of sepia?
Exactly. So that's why they're hard to see. But they would burn a negative image. But you would be able to see it. You know, if you get up to it, you can see it. But
so what's the reason for the landscape being on its head here, on its side? I mean, what does that do for us, like, with the relation to the chair?
Just imbalance, you know, with the extreme weather. I just wanted this feeling of imbalance and sort of like you're falling off a chair or something. I'm not quite sure.
And it's titled Work Dreams?
Work Dreams.
Do the titles, are they the impetus of the work, or do they follow, or?
It's literal.
It's literal?
Yeah, because I was painting houses, too, at this time, and I was really busy, and I was just fine that I would, at night, I was just dreaming about painting houses, and I just...
And there was a relationship between that and... extreme weather.
I think so. The imagery that I was working on, I think, was definitely connected to what I was doing during the day. But
well, I think that's what I appreciate about the work. The work I was introduced to is the more current work.
Right.
But is that it has this sort of disjunctive sort of feeling that that I think we think is... disjunctive, but I think it's really the way life works. I mean, I don't think things are quite... They're not ordered the way we see them in,
right.
in a picture that's not on its side. Or
I'd agree. There's another one.
Another one of the Vanishing Georges.
Right.
Yeah, this one I wanted to point out that... Do you want to talk a little bit about that image that's on his face? Because...
Right.
I'm speculating, just seeing it in reproduction.
That's one of the images from the La Fontaine, which is a collection of fables, French literature.
Mm-hmm.
Florian and La Fontaine. It's been redone many times by different authors, but there were all these engravings that were part of the original fables. J.J. Granville did those. He was the best one, I think. And they're sort of morality tales,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, let's see, one is sort of our version of the goose that laid the golden egg, and it has this image of this man sitting on the ground, and he has actually cut open this goose, and he's trying to find the egg, and he, of course he's killed the goose, so there's lots of irony.
Yeah, our version was much cleaner. Calmer.
Much cleaner,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Is this the first time you've done that with the Vanishing Georgia, or is that so? That's
it is
because that's relationship.
Right.
Did you know that this other imagery was coming, or did you?
I just happened on it, like most things. I mean, it seems like the best things you just land on. I mean, you don't know what happened, and so I was really interested in these images and I like the sort of. The way they sort of a folk tale, but then this hard photo with this pretty intense subject matter, and they sort of dispelled some of that. They brought in these other layers,
mm-hmm.
and I was trying to put as much in as I could. So, there were personal photos that were getting put into these boxes, and just all kinds of things you can't even see. I was really stuck on It's funny to think about all this. I was stuck on. Sign language hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I was putting all these. I was writing things with sign language hands, and you know, nobody knew what they were, and I wasn't going to tell them.
Somebody does. Somebody knows.
Somebody knows. Yeah, I'm sure. You know, that's
that became their point of entry
for them.
For the work.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, that's interesting that you would put the fable with the moral based fable that with this image of the man who's being. Judged validity.
Exactly.
And then with this new destruction, that shows up again later.
Yeah,
too.
I've used that word, that title a couple of times. But and this one's a little different. This is the same using the contact film.
Right.
And but I took what did I take? I took Frederick Church's The Heart of the Andes, which is this giant painting.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is amazing painting. And there's no people in it, I think, except one person. And I made a gigantic silkscreen out of it. And it's the whole, and it's on its side also, behind that.
Oh, now I see it.
Yeah, it's hard to see. Mm-hmm. And then I started, once again, using these images of weather, like extreme weather and earthquakes and tornadoes. And I was sort of contesting what he was stating. I mean, he had this image of beautiful nature, and I was doing the other thing, so... But then there's also this image of bees. That's actually an early swarm image where
right.
there's this hive and there's all these bees that are just coming out of.
I thought I recognized that.
Yeah.
Again, repeated later.
I've used that image quite a bit, the hive.
So that's kind of the nature of the work, as you develop this vocabulary of images, or this bank of images maybe.
That's
more
true.
Accurate. And then you can go in and mm-hmm. pull from that.
Yeah, and then you can just, and then it, I mean, you don't even need, it doesn't even need to be elaborate. It can just be like just part of that image. And to me, it signals something, and I don't always feel like I have to explain it, but like the hive image.
You said something in the statement about it, it was about nostalgia, and it was
I'm reluctant. I don't like nostalgia unless I can use it to, what was that?
Unless you could exploit it.
Exploit it, right.
For the sake of a good image or to
right.
build a good image, which as we move through, I'd be interested in hearing kind of how you came, like, okay, that's done. It's a good image. How
oh,
you
God.
Know. Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking that idea about exploiting, I'm working on something now. I've been using these, which is perfectly illustrates that sentence. I'm using these old water mills,
mm-hmm.
like with old buildings, and because I feel like it's the answer to our energy crisis, maybe. But you know,
it's good for Earth.
It's like let's go backwards, you know, let's not go forward. So I've found all these images of old water wheels, engravings, and it's a so I've got them in this landscape, and they're all linked up like in series, like electrical, like a conduit.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know, you know, what they're being linked up for, you know. But each of them has this sort of nostalgic feeling because it's like an old print. But then they've been completely hijacked, and I'm going to use them to do something else. And they don't, you know, they probably won't like it, but I don't care.
the water wheels won't like.
Yeah, they might not. I mean, you know, it's not their. It's something different than their original purpose. But I like that feeling in them that's nostalgic. But then they're being co-opted for
but
something
you're exploiting
else,
it,
right?
Yeah.
So that's what I meant.
But that's the good thing as an artist. They'll comply.
Right. They have.
They have to.
Right. They'll fight back. They definitely will fight back.
That's. I think you addressed some of those battles in this imagery. Okay, this one, maybe you could talk a little bit about third door. There are a couple of things, like the boxes are gone.
Boxes are gone.
But it still has sort of that patched together kind of, you know, block by block until you get down here and it starts sort of melding a little bit more.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's no more photo. It's all gone.
It's all so you're reproducing reproductions, kind of pre
right
non-photographic
right. Although the door is a photo, I took that photo, and then I went to somebody and we made it into a halftone. And this is sort of when you could go to a graphic art shop and they had these machines that would make mm-hmm. a halftone out of anything, so they could print it. Those machines are gone now. It's all gone, but. You know, you could use a really fine halftone dot matrix, and it would be almost photographic. It was so, because the dots were so small. And so I found that I could start to make those images without dealing with the photochemicals. So it was great. It was
mm-hmm.
like, okay, I don't need that anymore. I can just do it this way. So that's how I got into silkscreen, actually.
Is this silkscreen?
It is.
Is this one of the first ones?
It is.
Okay. Okay, where's the third door? There's a door.
Well, there's a door on the edge, and...
Yeah,
that's a door.
Oh, got it. Okay, I couldn't find it.
Right.
Find the third door.
So it's like the door, you're backing out of the painting, and then there's this third door, which is your first door. But
You've said something about how that the photo emulsion pieces, the photograph pieces, you felt like you were on the outside looking in
right.
at them.
Mm-hmm.
And with these, you feel like you're on the inside looking out. I do kind of sense that you paint yourself into a corner, so to speak, that you get in there. And,
Well, definitely now on the inside. I mean, here I'm more lost. You know,
right.
I don't know what, you know.
Because this hasn't, this is a transition
right.
of sort.
Right, exactly.
There's that door again, or a different door.
Yeah. St. Dog.
Mm-hmm. There he is.
Yeah.
That's so good. St. Dog.
Yeah.
I'm going to move through some of these kind of quickly. There's that swarm image that you were talking about earlier.
Right.
And here it really is starting to read as one. It's coming together. It's kind of unifying. It doesn't have that box. You've lost your box.
Right. There's still doors. You can't see them, but they're in both upper corners. There's like the bees are either going into the doors or coming out of the doors. There's open doors in the corners.
Oh, okay.
So it's hard to see. You know.
Is that what you, I mean, what do you attribute the doors to?
I had an apartment that had a lot of doors.
No.
I did. It was a classic Victorian. I had this hallway that had about 13 doors. I mean, they were just, you would walk into the hallway and there'd be all these doors. And I just thought, you know, I've just got to do something with this. Seriously, that's it. And those are those doors, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great metaphor, too.
Yes,
but,
it is.
You know.
Like, are they trap doors or...
Probably.
with this one, and I don't even know if our dates are lining up here, but this was the order you gave them to me, and I this one seems like it's really come together. You are kind of setting up a story of sorts,
mm-hmm.
and I don't look at it, you know, part by part by part. I start looking at the whole thing. In fact, there isn't. It's losing that even, you know, a point of entry. The others didn't have so much a point. The emulsion pieces kind of had a point of entry.
Sort of. I mean, it's always tipped up.
Right.
The landscape's always tipped up. Somebody said it's sort of like Chinese painting. I don't really see it that way because for me, they're very dimensional. I can move around in them. That's the way I work on them. I'm like in them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think, I mean, they did change quickly. I mean, it's almost like... Quickly, I decided that I really just wanted to fill them up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a horror vacui obsession.
Yeah, that just every.
You know, now they're even more like that. I
right.
mean, it's like more and more. So.
Well, with this one, the Lomax from 2002, we talked earlier about my interest in the way that this light falls on this.
Mm-hmm.
On this plant form here, and I mean, there's so much about this that we can. I mean, we could spend all hour on this, but that just fascinates me, and I don't know why it caught my attention because I'm sure there are all kinds of elements in there to suggest this. But it was as if this is obviously a place of the imagination for
mm-hmm.
me,
mm-hmm.
and I think I'm just so struck by the fact that this place of imagination is being affected by the physical world with the way that the light falls on this plant form. But like I said, it's probably elsewhere. And when I said that, you said that's really important.
It is. I'm very conscious of the light, and it's almost always falling from my right to my left. And if I even have an image that I try to keep the light, this is such a weird thing to, I never really talk about it, but I always, the source of light is really important in the painting and it has to be consistent. So that I'll even, if I have an image that I've drawn and the light falls on one side, I'll change it to make it fit the painting. I'll make the light fall on the other side so that it lines up with everything else that's in the painting that has the light falling on that side. So that's the way I orient myself in the painting. You know, I have to believe that I'm there, or I can't work on it. And if I see something flipped, it's going to bother me.
Well, that must be why we stay with it too, because it's really disjunctive. I mean, if we were able to see every little detail, we would see that these things don't all necessarily go together. You've put them together.
Right, but they do. They do go back. You know, they.
You create a kind of order in that.
Yeah,
way.
They do. I mean, you know, the thing in front eclipses the thing behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm very conscious of so that your eye is going back in space. You know, not, they're not just on top; they actually are in space.
So you are kind of moving us through this
Absolutely.
Composition. Because there's
yeah.
a lot written about this kind of overallness of the work, but maybe
right.
it's more the color pieces that we'll come to later, the monochrome pieces that we'll come to later, but
yeah.
this kind of overallness. And I, you know, I buy that. Like with these, at first I think you're leading me through, you're leading me back into, and then I realize it's just frustrated because it's like this labyrinth of, you know, I can't really follow it.
Mm-hmm. I think the painting would be a little actually easier to absorb, the actual painting, because
right.
because the way it does fall back, you know, the lines are much more clear. You know, it's really clear,
right.
clean.
It's no, I know it's really crisp.
Yeah,
I mean, that
crisp,
was what
right.
I was struck by. As you move up to it, it's
right.
really crisp, and you can make out the detail. For example, this little rabbit
yeah.
that's in the door of this like.
Yeah, he's that, just like, where am I? You know?
I think of like Uncle
that's
Wrigley
me.
Or something. That's you. Where
yeah.
am I? One of those mini doors in your apartment.
Yeah, no, I...
And then what's happening like back in here?
Well, there's all these mushrooms and, you know, it's...
We get a, there they are.
Yeah. And there's holes in the ground and there's this all these mushrooms that are circling this leaf table.
Holes. Circling a leaf table?
It's a leaf table, yeah. You can see it up in the corner. Right in there. There's a leaf table.
So they're gathering for, like, dinner or something?
Or just, yeah.
Just gathering?
I don't always nail... In fact, I try hard not to nail the story down because
right.
But I just... I mean, mostly in this painting, I knew that I wanted this sort of swirl
mm-hmm.
at the top. This swirl of energy,
mm-hmm.
so it's like you go up to this swirl,
right?
And you know, and then what's the focus of the swirl? I mean, it could almost be anything, but the leaf table seemed like the best thing.
It's just kind of like that. And is the leaf table something that you found, an image you found somewhere, or did you draw the leaf table?
I've found a few of them actually. Yeah, there's in old illustrations,
like fairy,
right? Because they're always like you know. What are you going to use for a table, you know?
I love this stuff. This is fairyland.
It is, kind of. But it's more menacing, too.
Yeah, well, fairyland is menacing.
It is,
yeah,
for me.
It doesn't take long. Well, it doesn't take long as a child to realize that that's not all. I mean, you know.
And then there's these sort of stacked towers, these doorways, and I'm actually still mm-hmm. using those quite a bit, where you sort of have these different levels. Of towers with open doors, and they're almost like mirrors of each other. There's right there in that one, you can definitely see it.
Okay, we'll get to this in a second. But why don't we, while we're looking at this, why don't you talk to us about how these are made? Because I think that process is really interesting because they're very different than the photo emulsion pieces.
Right. Although the way they're anyway, the way they're made now is more rote. I make a big drawing, the same size as the painting, so it's 1:1. And I work on that for a long time, months. And it's sort of a big sandwich of drawing and imagery and things from a copy machine. And then when I have the image mostly right, then we chop it up into little pieces, you know, about the size of a piece of paper like this, you
mm-hmm.
know, which, and I hate to chop it up, but I have to, because we put it into a scanner, and then we reassemble it in the computer. And what that, because what I'm trying to do is get to the point where I can make silk screens, because there's no way to make these marks with brushes, they're too small. So after we put it into that, put it in the computer and stitch it back together. Then I march it over to this other guy that has this big laser printer, and he uses the same ortho film that I used to use in the old transparencies.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's black on clear. Mm-hmm. And we make a bitmap so that there's no grayscale, because that would just fall. You wouldn't be able to use that in a silkscreen. It's real black and white. Mm-hmm. But we're able to make these bitmaps that are just, you know, the teeniest dark mark. So the lines get really fine. And then we make silkscreens. And to make a painting about, well, what's that? My paintings are mostly bigger now, but that's about 16 screens. So you screen one image, and then you have to let it dry, and then you line up the next one with it, and then you screen that, and you're sort of tiling the painting to completion.
Tiling it a lot like that earlier work.
But exactly
the
right.
The tile showed in the earlier work, and here to not have the tile, you go back in.
Right. I'm trying to fix it so that you cannot see any kind of seams or anything. And it's we're getting so good at the silk screening that mm-hmm. Although I'm doing all the silk screen, I just have somebody help me with the film. That it's pretty. There's really not too much to do. It's pretty good. And then
in terms of the coming in between, you don't have that much more.
Right. Unless I'm leaving images out. Sometimes I'll leave an image out because I'm not sure about it. So it'll be a blank spot. And then after I've done the screen work, I can go in and fill it in however I want, and I would just use brushes for that.
Little tiny brushes.
Yeah.
John Yao writes in his catalog essay for one of your shows, he's writing about this piece, which is King and Queen, and he talks about how it recedes into this intricately detailed landscape while these paths seem to, at the same time, pull your attention upward. The paths seem to be both paths, or these marks seem to be both paths, and flat abstract shapes or these kind of meandering bands. And what he says that does is it reminds us that King and Queen, this painting, is both a picture and a flat thing. That it's a labyrinthine world that can be contemplated rather than something that you get lost in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about that? Like how you're moving? I mean, you've mentioned that before, how you're moving us back. But at the same time, they can read either as something functional or they can read as these abstract marks. And to sort of reinforce that potential.
Oh, you're talking about the green?
I was talking about these. That's what John Yao's talking about, I think, is these kind of gouges almost in the painting. And they have a function. They obviously are part of a landscape that you're describing there. But then you also could look at that almost by squinting your eyes a little bit and see them as these white marks in the painting. And then it seems like you sort of reinforce the possibility of that, of them operating as these abstract marks, by coming in and flattening the painting mm-hmm. out with those. Like, in case we were believing this,
mm-hmm.
you put those green bands on there that kind of knock it back or flatten it out. And, of course, what he's referring to is that you're involved in this storytelling, but you're also a painter that is a product of mm-hmm. his heritage mm-hmm. as a painter.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that, or are you conscious of that?
I think I agree with that more in these than I do in what I'm making now.
Oh, okay.
Because although the white bands operate like a pathway for me, and I'm using them to get into the painting. So when I'm in the studio, you know, that's getting me. I'm using that path just to push me into the painting, and I didn't. And when he started talking about what he said in that essay, I kind of didn't get it because I didn't quite agree with him because mm-hmm. I felt like he wasn't quite understanding the way those operate. And he was going through those bands onto the blank canvas, which is what it is. It's just blank canvas,
uh-huh.
and I don't have that problem. To me, they don't shift. They operate as pathways, and they keep operating that way. But the green bands actually used to have words on them.
Oh.
Yeah, they had all these labels, and I decided I just hated it. And I just,
why?
But I liked them because it just, I don't, it was corny. I just thought it was really corny.
What did they say?
I'm not going to tell you. So I just, but I liked the way that they floated. Uh-huh. I liked that feeling. So I just painted it out in the same color, but I erased the words. And And I just stop because you just get hysterical. You know, you don't know where they keep going or stop or what am I going to do. And
so you made yourself stop.
So I made, that was it. I just painted out those words and said, forget about it.
Running out of time, so we've got to keep moving. Okay. There are so many more things that I want to talk about. I have to say, just this line here, I thought, again, I was with John Yao, and I thought that this was just another way for you to remind us that this is a painting, you know, in case we were believing it as a story or a place. And I ask you about that line, and you said it's the wind.
Yeah, for me, it's this thing blowing through the painting. And it does, I can see how it would read flat, but to me it doesn't. To me it's very dimensional.
Yes.
So
it's just, it's to me it's dimensional but inconsistent with this.
Like right.
It's on
that's
top
true.
Of. So it.
But that's just me trying to get more in. You know, I'm always trying to get more in. So it's like, well, if I put this thing blowing through the painting, that's not
wind.
In here already. So that's good.
I think that's so brilliant because it's so obvious, but brilliant that in order to make wind, you don't do that drawing of the, you know, that you.
Right. You could have put line. You know, like.
But to animate a string is to show movement or wind. I love that. Hmm. And I'm really curious about like what he's up to there. Is that same?
Well, he's running away from that. There's a battle going on.
Of rats.
Rats and weasels, right?
Oops, sorry. Okay, this one is home, and you talked about. I mean, I told you earlier that dream work. Mm-hmm. It reminds me. I think, for one thing, it's kind of this is a much more minimal composition. But then also, I think it's the buckets or something.
Mm-hmm.
But this one's kind of personal.
Yeah, it's a little. That one's a little more empty, but the growing tree is actually it's a floor plan of my apartment where I was living. So I just thought...
So this tree, I see.
I would make it grow that way.
And then are these some of those blank areas that you talk about, but you decided not to put something in?
There was something there, but I just blanked it out, sort of like the label, the green labels. You know, so you could start to play with that. It's like, you know, of course a lot of people are doing that, you know, like... Christopher Wool or something. I mean, they're painting out things, and it's like, so what's behind that? There's a compelling feeling there, but you'll never know what it was. So it's this whole erasure thing. I've left that. I'm not doing that anymore. But I was doing that for a while.
Just to create desire, or so you can't know it all, or.
It's impulsive. So I don't know. You know, I just couldn't live with that image. It just was too literal or too...
You know what you keep talking about, the paths are to get you in. And I sort of picture you, like, leaving your body and going into this painting and working on it sort of from the inside, almost as if you're painting these things from the backside or something.
Backside.
Yeah, almost as if you're like in there painting it out toward us.
Uh-huh.
Do you think about the viewer in the process of making?
Only in this, I think in the sense, is it readable? Or is there something, because I can tell, it's like my eye gravitates towards the problems all the time. I'm always looking at the problems and trying to fix the problem and make it more readable. So, I mean, I'm you that way because I want to be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So
the same paths that get you in to work on it get us in to look at it?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, I'm definitely...
Well, we're really, really just about out of time here. So
okay.
Maybe you could talk about just this body of work with the monochrome paintings, and I'll go through some of these images. What brought you to, these are very different than the black and whites.
Right.
Both in the fact that there's color and the depth. They're much more shallow, or it's almost as though there's a veil over them as opposed to space you move into.
Right, there is. So so these paintings, very full and complex, and screening them onto the background, and then I'm putting washes of the same color paint to diminish them, to push them back into space and make them, sometimes they're quite hard to see, you know, mm-hmm. you really have to look, and sometimes they're more visible. So it's, you sort of got that whole thing going too. It's like you can make it really tough to see it, except maybe part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just really interested in, this one actually is pretty visible, but it, mm-hmm. but it, you have this whole atmosphere because you're, you called it a fog, and it, mm-hmm. it kind of is like that, but it definitely isolates the image more. It becomes more of its own world, I mean, to me, mm-hmm. working on them. And when it's to the point of putting these washes on, that's all I can do. I can't work on them anymore. It's a way of stopping,
oh, yeah.
too. So it's like
it's
you're done.
It's another device to right. deal with yourself. This one, I just have to...
It's a teeny little painting.
Yeah, it is. Compared to your others, mm-hmm. there's some really small works at the end, too, that I was fascinated by. But I just have to say that when I was reading what different people had said about the work, what was it that Roberta Smith said? That your work was... She said it was something like Beatrice Potter filtered through Darwin.
Yeah.
And I definitely thought of that when I saw it.
Yeah.
I'm looking at those crystals, the rock forms here that you talked about too. This, I'm really fascinated by the camouflage of this piece, kind of visually mm-hmm. and conceptually. The little gnomes.
Yeah, there's all these images in there, and I'm just using the flower matrix almost like a image. So there's this woman, and then this axe, and...
Is this the one where all the gnomes have flowers in their eyes?
Yeah, exactly.
So that they're sort
kind of invisible.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The idea of that world.